Good morning. My name is Leslie Goldstein. My attorney registration number is 24658. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Hazelwood. The reason I requested oral arguments was really specifically for the mistrial issue. I believe the admission of prior bad acts pursuant to Rule 404B tainted Mr. Hazelwood's entire trial from start to finish. In fact, when I was reviewing the record last night again, I noticed that there was actually a seventh time that defense counsel requested a mistrial that was following Mr. Hazelwood testifying. There was a jury question that was asked, which is found in the record at volume 2, page 213, which I believe is juror question number 7. And it essentially wanted to inquire what were the, quote, frequency of disturbances that were occurring from that apartment. I think that question at the very end of the trial indicates and demonstrates that the jurors were very cognizant of the prior bad act evidence and were unable to put that aside. Judge Spear was the second judge who presided over the trial and ultimately found that the prior bad act evidence was being purely used as propensity evidence and should not have been admitted. The problem with that ruling is that occurred after voir dire, where the public defender voir dired somewhat extensively on the attempted first degree assault conviction, in which Mr. Hazelwood shot his then girlfriend in the arm following a dispute. Certainly significant and abhorrent crime there. The second piece of 404B evidence which was admitted was where the defendant purportedly got into an argument with his current girlfriend's niece over belongings in a locked car, which resulted in a somewhat physical altercation. In my mind, significant was that was not even a domestic violence related incident.
Ms. Goldstein, may I interrupt you? You say admitted, but yet that evidence was not admitted, was it? It was talked about in voir dire and in opening, but it was not admitted, and the court gave an instruction on it.
That is true, Judge. The court precluded that evidence and gave a curative instruction, and what essentially happened is this was on the second day of trial. In the morning, the court basically said, I find that this evidence smacks of propensity evidence, and I'm not going to allow the prosecutor to get into this evidence. At that time, defense counsel got up a second time and said, I'm asking for a mistrial because I've already voir dired and we've already talked about this in opening. At which point the court said, well, voir dire and opening statements are not evidence. I agree with those statements. The problem is this information was already posited with the jury. In fact, throughout jury selections, I believe four or five jurors were dismissed outright because they could not, because they had such a bias, they manifested a bias against Mr. Hazelwood based on this bad character evidence. And certainly I raised on this appeal, but also during the challenges for cause that were ultimately denied to five jurors, at least three of them had, in my opinion, exhibited bias against Mr. Hazelwood for these prior bad acts. And in fact, as we continue throughout the trial, there are juror questions that continue to raise the inference that these were not isolated incidents. The question that I highlighted in the brief talked about, was asked of the complaining witness, RS, what prompted you to call the police this time? Certainly, I think there's an inference that there were numerous other incidents of domestic violence between Mr. Hazelwood and the complaining witness. And I believe that tracks through towards the end of the trial, after Mr. Hazelwood testified, when there was another juror question asked, which also asked about what the number of the frequency of disturbances that occurred. I was reviewing many other cases which talked about mistrial in the last couple days. And after, again, rereading everything that occurred in Mr. Hazelwood's case, it really, to me, begs the question of what exactly needs to happen to have a mistrial actually granted. It seemed like there was error after error after error. I know the court characterized the prosecutor, I don't know if he used the word inadvertence, but certainly I think there was some sloppiness. It might have been a word used by the trial court when the district attorney continued to elicit evidence that Mr. Hazelwood was in the Department of Corrections, and then
that was reference to a letter that was sent, and they asked where it came from, and they sustained the objection, but then by inference, the question was asked again.
That's correct. I believe the prosecutor then stood up and said, I don't want to ask where the letter came from, but, yeah. And again, that prompted the fourth request for a mistrial. So all told, we have seven times where the defense asked for a mistrial. That one of the cases that I cited, People v. Owens, in that case, a mistrial was granted. And actually what occurred is there were, I guess it was evidence that the defense had wanted to get in. Ultimately, the trial court held that that evidence was not admissible, I believe, under the rape shield statute. During either cross-examination or opening statements, defense counsel basically made a statement implying that the victim in Owens had a boyfriend, in other words, bringing up the specter of evidence that had previously been precluded. And at that time, the court granted a mistrial, and they subsequently had a trial the next day in front of a different judge. While in this case, the court order granted the 404B evidence, I think it's significant that ultimately Judge Speer did make the right decision and excluded the evidence. The problem is that that decision to exclude this propensity evidence came too late. It wasn't just a fleeting mention of these two prior bad acts. There was large discussions over it during voir dire, which spawned a whole host of juror concerns over their ability to be fair to Mr. Hazelwood.
And does it make any difference that Mr. Hazelwood testified and that evidence of the felonies came in?
I do not believe so, and there's two reasons that I argued that. To begin with, what the state argued is that by virtue of him testifying, the prior felony convictions would be introduced. What I cited in my briefs is that it's only the fact of the conviction, not the actual underlying facts of those convictions. And certainly the case or the issue that we're talking about, shooting the former girlfriend in the arm, Mr. Hazelwood ultimately pled guilty to an attempted first degree assault, which I'm not quite sure how many lay people would actually even know what that meant. But certainly, many people had a visceral reaction to hearing Mr. Hazelwood shot his former girlfriend in the arm. Be that as it may, the actual testimony that came out when Mr. Hazelwood testified was defense counsel basically posited a question to Mr. Hazelwood asking essentially whether or not this was self-defense. And the only thing Mr. Hazelwood said in response was, she came at me with a butcher knife. And then that prompted some objections, but that was really the only substantive discussion during Mr. Hazelwood's testimony that came out about that prior bad act.
Counsel, I would like to ask you about your arguments on voir dire.
Yes.
would you?
Absolutely.
I know you listed certain jurors that you felt should have been, the challenge for cause should have been granted, but I'd like to hear your.
Yes, of course. Thank you. Well, specifically, there were, I believe, five jurors. I'm not going to focus on Juror Kelly, which I believe was the one who had the law enforcement bias. I think that stands alone. What I'm trying to weave through here is that these other jurors that the trial court did not grant the challenge for cause, I believe that they did have these biases against Mr. Hazelwood based on the prior bad act evidence. Indeed, one of the female jurors, I believe was Shaw, his mother had been a victim of violent crime. And when the trial court ultimately denied that request, the trial court found that the, one of the jurors
it was,
had been
a, Mr. Shaw, the one that had been a victim of a rape at 19?
Yes, at 19. And what the trial court ultimately said when denying that was, well, this woman is now 54 years of age, so a significant period of time has gone by, and I don't see that that would affect her ability to be fair or impartial. I think the problem is the record belies that, is this juror was very straightforward about how that affected her and how she had concerns about whether or not she would be able to be fair, knowing the type of person that Mr. Hazelwood was.
Ultimately, the court asked a question of the whole panel as to whether there are any people who felt that they would not be able to be impartial and serve, and apparently Ms. Shaw did not raise her hand in response to that. Does that have the effect of rehabilitating her? That would be your
well, problem. Judge, I think the problem with that is the judge asked that to the entire proposed panel instead of specifically talking with Juror Shaw about that issue. And I think because Juror Shaw was straightforward and forthcoming about those issues, that the just a blanket question to the general panel, I don't believe sufficiently rehabilitates that juror. And again, I think these jurors continually had questions and concerns with this 404B evidence, which then continued on. Now, defense counsel ended up striking that juror using a peremptory challenge, but I think it ultimately shows that these were not just isolated incidents mentioned once. The 404B evidence was talked about throughout the trial in various contexts, and ultimately, because of that, the trial court should have granted the request for a mistrial. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Jones. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I'll go ahead and begin by addressing the defendant's motions for mistrial and the court's rulings on those motions. Now, as the court is aware, mistrial is a drastic remedy that is only appropriate where the error cannot be cured by any other means. In this case, while there was mention of the prior acts, the 404B evidence, in both jury selection and in opening statements, the jury was instructed that the statements of counsel was not evidence. They were instructed that the fact of the defendant's prior convictions could only be used in determining the credibility of the defendant. And no evidence of those prior acts was admitted at trial other than what was attempted to be introduced by defense counsel during the examination of the defendant. Additionally, I think it's important to note that the jury did acquit the defendant of two charges in this case, both the witness tampering and the child abuse charges. And with respect to the witness tampering, both the reference to DOC and Exhibit 32A, which was the letter that the defendant sent from DOC, that weighed heavily on, or the prosecution relied heavily on that evidence in arguing that the jury should convict the defendant of witness tampering. However, the jury acquitted the defendant of that count, but shows that the jury was not so prejudiced by the introduction of this evidence that they were not able to form an opinion on a proper basis and consider the evidence presented and follow the instructions of the court in this case. I think it's also important for the court to note the weight of the admissible evidence in this case. This was not a situation where the defendant denied that the assault had occurred in this case. His argument was simply that he didn't intend to cause bodily injury to the victim and that his hands were not deadly weapons as used in this case. The defendant did admit that he had struck the victim. His argument was just that he didn't intend the bodily injury. There was, of course, also the testimony of the victim. There was testimony of the doctor that examined the victim, as well as testimony from the police officers and a neighbor that had heard screaming during the incident. So I think when the court weighs both the nature of the evidence at issue here, the weight of the admissible evidence, and the fact that the court did give the jury a cautionary instruction, this court should find that the court did not abuse its discretion in denying the defendant's motions for mistrial in this case. With respect to the challenges for cause, I'll just touch briefly on that since Judge Plank asked. I do believe that the court properly rehabilitated the jurors in this case to the extent that it was necessary. The court gave a very lengthy instruction to all of the jurors talking about the burden of proof, the presumption of innocence, biases, bents of mind, as he put it, how the jurors should weigh those things, how they need to put aside that and focus on the evidence presented and follow the instructions from the court. And at the end of all of that, defense counsel approached the jury and said to them, you know, this is not something everyone can do. Everybody can't put this into the back of their mind if they're instructed to. But then he specifically said to the jurors that he had already spoken to, has anybody I have spoken with after hearing that say, I changed my mind, I'm going to be fair, I'm going to be impartial because I've been instructed to? Or do these biases interfere with your ability to sit in fair judgment in this case? And then he asked the jurors to raise their hand if they were going to have a problem. So defense counsel specifically referenced the jurors that he had previously spoken to and asked them what impact the court's supplemental instruction had. And the jurors that he had previously spoken to did not raise their hands and indicate that they would not be able to be fair and impartial in this case. So to the extent that any rehabilitation was necessary, the court's instruction was sufficient.
Ms. Jones, let me ask you this. Juror Shaw, I think, was the one that talked about that Judge Plank mentioned had been raped when she was 19. She specifically said she could not grant the defendant the presumption of innocence.
She did. And again, that was prior to the court giving the jury that supplemental instruction talking about the fact that the presumption that the defendant is entitled to the presumption of innocence and that the prosecution has the burden of proof. The court also noted in its findings the leading nature of the questions asked by defense counsel in reaching its decision that the juror could be fair and impartial in this case. So I think that the court was entitled to look both at the leading nature of the questions as well as the juror's demeanor at the time and consider her response to the supplemental instruction and defense counsel's follow-up question asking if anyone is still having a problem with this after the court's instruction and the fact that she didn't at that point raise her hand and say that she could no longer do so.
Didn't she really raise this on her own? Want affirmatively to point out that she has this problem because of her mother's situation?
Well, she had listed that, I believe, in her jury questionnaire that she had been a victim of a crime. Defense counsel asked how that affected her ability in this case, and she said, you know, this is going to be tough for her to be impartial, and defense counsel said, well, is it a serious doubt? Do you have a serious doubt in your mind? And she said, well, she said, serious doubt in my mind that would not bias me. And then he said, so as you sit here and look at Mr. Hazelwood, you think to yourself, I am not able to presume him innocent now, and she said, that's right. So it was defense counsel that brought up whether or not she could provide the defendant with the presumption of innocence. It was his word about serious doubt that he had injected into the jury selection. And again, when we have responses that could go either way, we have to give some deference to the trial court's ability to observe this juror, to listen to the questions asked, the answers given, the nature of the questions and the way the jury responded in making his decision to deny the challenge for cause.
the overall tenor of the last instruction, so to speak, that the court gave was, can you be fair and impartial? But that's a pretty blanket statement. I mean, if a juror is sitting there and has expressed doubt that she can give a presumption of innocence to the defendant, does a blanket instruction saying, can you be fair and impartial, does that trigger a belief in the juror that, well, you know, yeah, I can be fair and impartial, but I can't grant him the presumption of innocence? Those two aren't necessarily consistent, are they?
They're not, but I don't think that the court's instruction was simply a, you need to be fair and impartial. When the court gave its instruction, it specifically referenced both the burden of proof and the presumption of innocence. It instructed the jury that cases should be tried on the evidence, the assessment of the credibility of witnesses, whether the prosecution has met its burden, that it has to base its decision on the instructions given by the court, that the jury would have to be able to disregard certain information if it was instructed to do so. It also talked extensively about, a lot of the jurors had mentioned their biases or their feelings or their particular bents of mind, and the court specifically instructed the juror that that is not how you decide cases, and that cases need to be decided based on the evidence presented and the law given by the court. And the court also said that if you can't do this, this is something that we need to know and we want to hear this. And then defense counsel followed up, not simply saying, raise your hand if you can't be fair and impartial, but he specifically said, is there anyone that I've already spoken to that has a change of mind, that can now be fair, that is now going to be impartial? You know, I've received these instructions, I can now follow that. Raise your hand if you can't do that. And these jurors did not do that. So this wasn't just a simple statement. The court's instruction was actually quite lengthy. And defense counsel did follow up and specifically referenced the jurors that he had previously spoken to in asking them how this instruction affected them. And these particular jurors did not re-raise their hand and indicate that they were still having trouble or would not be able to follow the instructions of the court. And multiple jurors did. So it was certainly clear to the panel that the court was willing and open to hearing from any of them if they did have any problems, and in fact specifically said that to them as well. So the court was open to hearing from any of the jurors if they felt that they still had concerns about their ability to follow the instructions and be fair and impartial in this case. If the court has no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm the defendant's convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Briefly. Thank you. What I would respond to the state is, defense counsel's questions of Juror Shaw were not leading questions. They did not suggest an answer to this juror. And in fact, I don't believe that the Juror Shaw's responses were unequivocal. She was very candid that she had concerns about her ability to be fair and impartial to Mr. Hazelwood. So I would suggest to the court that the court should not be looking specifically at what defense counsel was saying, but really what Juror Shaw was taking time out to speak and tell defense counsel how she felt about these things. Ultimately, I believe that the prior bad act evidence that was introduced in the beginning of trial did taint and did affect Mr. Hazelwood's right to have a fair trial. This court, although the state disagreed with me, I believe this court should be looking at mistrial as a standard of review as constitutional harmless error and come to the conclusion that this was not harmless error. But for the introduction of this evidence at the beginning of trial, it tainted and ultimately deprived Mr. Hazelwood of his right to have a fair trial. So I would ask this court to reverse the judgment of conviction and remand the case for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.